Good morning. My name's Ruth. I'm one of the pastors here. And this is our third week in the series Hope and the Four Horsemen of the Apocalypse. And as we've said in past weeks, that's meant to be a bit of a fun title, a provocative title, or an evocative title, maybe I should say. So this is not a series about the book of Revelation. Sorry if you were looking forward to that. And it's certainly not a series about the end of the world and God destroying the world or anything like that. But it is about finding hope in some pretty bleak, scary, overwhelming situations, ones where it feels like pretty hopeless. Because we live in a culture that experiences a lot of angst about what's going on in the world. We're bombarded with information about natural disasters and wars and disease outbreaks, and we get to see that, right? So on the evening news or in our news feed online throughout the day, we get to see real-life nightmare scenarios. We get to hear and see people responding in the immediate aftermath of some of the worst things that could possibly happen to them. So if we have any sense of empathy, that can create a lot of anxiety for us. The world can seem very scary in many ways. And those fears are often reflected in popular culture. So we have lots of books and movies about various doomsday scenarios. I don't mean the ones with the aliens or monkeys taking over the planet, but, you know, those ones where there's some outbreak of a disease that takes out a large swathe of the population, or there's some kind of a crop blight, or there's nuclear war, or there's, you know, all those kind of situations which, hopefully, they're extremely unlikely, but they're not totally impossible, and they, you know, it makes for exciting stories. I kind of like those books and movies where the odds are stacked against the human race, and it's just down to those few people with their bravery and their skill and maybe some clever plot twists, and they pull humanity back from the brink to save us from annihilation. That makes for good books and good movies. But what I really don't like, I know a lot of people do, but I don't like, are post-apocalyptic books and movies. My husband likes them, so I've seen a whole bunch of them. But for me, they're really kind of depressing. Occasionally, there's a good one, and I think, oh, that was kind of clever. But often, I find them just really depressing because they seem so hopeless. I'm kind of a fix-it person. So, you know, I see a situation and think, okay, we've got to come up with a plan, get the resources together, and go fix this problem. Whereas post-apocalyptic scenarios tend to be hopelessly unfixable because you can't reverse the apocalypse. I read a lot with my youngest son at night. He likes to have a story read to him, and we've read hundreds of books, all different genres, and he was bought a set of books that were highly acclaimed, but it's a kid's version of a post-apocalyptic scenario, and I just couldn't read them. I knew that this bunch of kids was going to get picked off one by one, that whatever happened, it was going to end badly. I was just like, we can't read this. We need to focus on something more hopeful. I can't read this before we go to sleep every night. So, but there are some topics, there are some issues that feel like that. They feel like no matter what you do, it's going to end badly. And that's what this series is about, looking at those kind of things. It feels too screwed up. It feels like it'd be better off focusing on something where we could do something positive. And hunger and poverty can feel like one of those things, one of those issues. Famine was the third horseman in that vision that the writer of the book of Revelation had. And it's easy to see why. World hunger, world famine, world poverty can just seem really scary and overwhelming. Because honestly, what can you do? The population is skyrocketing. In the 20th century, the world population quadrupled. We now have over 7 billion people. And as we were looking at a couple of weeks ago, we've made large areas of our planet unsuitable for growing crops through through deforestation, through pollution, through global climate change. We've overfished the seas, et cetera, et cetera. And millions of people are starving. It can feel incredibly hopeless. What do you do in a situation like that? Well, let's look at a few statistics about hunger around the world. There are lots of different ways of measuring hunger. So different measures of hunger reveal different aspects. But roughly speaking, there are about 800 million people going hungry around the world. That's 1 in 9 people on the planet are hungry. And poor nutrition, so that's a lack of food, lack of nutrients, unsafe food, causes nearly half all deaths in children under the age of 5. So that's over 3 million children each year die of nutrition-related causes. That's 6 children under the age of 5 every minute of every day. It's horrendous. And every so often there's a photo of someone who's starving that will go viral. I don't know if you saw the one a few weeks ago of a 1-month-old Syrian baby. I'm not going to show it. I'm not going to show any photos of people starving. Personally, I find those photos kind of dehumanizing. But we've all seen them, right? And they're horrendous, and you see them, and you're affected for a moment, and maybe we do something. Maybe we make a donation or something. Most of the time, we don't. We just kind of have to look away because it's overwhelming. Because even if you can save that one baby, there's still another 8,500 children under the age of 5 that will die that day of malnutrition, and the next day, and the next day. It just seems too much. So we look away. And I think it's somewhat easier to look away when the people that are hungry and starving are different to us. They're far away. They don't look like us. They don't have a lifestyle that's like ours. Because we can't take care of the world, right? That has to be someone else's problem. But then we think about hunger in America, in our own communities. 1 in 8 Americans, that's over 56 million people, went hungry for some or all of last year. I want us to listen for just a couple of minutes to one family's experience with hunger in America. So we'll just watch that.
I'm a single working mom. I work 40 hours a week, sometimes more. I'm raising 2 girls, Ashley, who's 8, and Elizabeth, who's 5, which is a big burden with daycare expenses and that with working all the time.
I'm, like, hungry when it's bedtime, but I never ask because I always know we need food for the next day.
Yeah, I'm hungry, love. A ton.
This year's been the most difficult year for us. Took the car in to find out that's $500. Okay, how do I pay for that? And put food on the table. At the end of the month, what's left for food is between $50 to $100. I mean, it gets really tough. You know, being a parent now myself, knowing the expectations and the dreams you have for your kids, knowing that you don't want them where you're at. Food insecurity is not knowing how long what you have in the cupboard is going to last, if you're going to have enough in the next paycheck to get the next 2 weeks worth until the next paycheck comes. There has been times where here's a bag of popcorn that you guys two can split. Oh, we're still hungry. We ate dinner. We had popcorn for dinner, kids.
When it comes to food, I take care of Beth. I'm more like a mother. At school sometimes and all, she's like dragging herself because she's hungry.
All right, girls, dinner's ready.
Oh, I'm going to be
pregnant. One thing I love is salad, but we never have enough money for it.
I do worry about whether or not they are eating healthy enough. They probably should get more fruits and vegetables. Busy, busy day today. Get your coat.
I think people don't realize how many people do struggle because it doesn't look like the typical place you would expect people to be struggling in.
It took me a year to go to Missions for All Nations food pantry. I was already charging groceries to the credit card. In order to get out of this vicious cycle, there has to be something. Let's see if we can get to a better place.
Okay, here's some corn for you. You could just fill out the front side.
Just have to swallow your pride to walk through those doors to admit in some ways you have failed.
Jennifer?
I can't believe I'm here, that I'm in this situation.
It feels sad because we don't get the food we want, but happy because we at least get some food.
I work, I'm making decent money, but if it's not one thing, it's another. This could happen to anybody at any time because you never know. You have one thing on top of another on top of another till it just seems to spiral out of control and then you're in need. Free time's a lot of volunteering here and there. for help and assistance, because then I don't feel like I'm abusing it. Helping out not only helps the other people, but it also does help us with being able to take home those food packages when we need them. I do volunteer other places too to help make ends meet.
You can like see all these different people who are in need. I feel sad for them, but I also feel happy that they can at least get some food, some comfort. As long as we have enough, I'm happy. That's all you really need.
It's appalling, isn't it, that a hardworking mom can't put enough food on the table, that her kids are going to school hungry, going to bed hungry. And obviously, Jennifer is just one of millions of people in that situation in America. If you Google hungry in America, you'll get scores and scores of videos just like this, where people have lost a job, or they've got hit with medical bills, or something else that acts as a shock, and it just starts to get worse and worse. So even though they're doing everything right, so to speak, they end up not being able to put food on their table for their families. Hunger is pervasive. It's in countries all around the world. We see it in brutal footage of kids with distended bellies and skeletal people, but it's also hidden in that normal working family next door that actually doesn't know where their next meal is coming from. So how can we find hope when we're faced with this problem of hunger? Or should we just look away, focus on something that we can fix, where we can make a difference? Well, before I came to work for Cedar Ridge a little over a year ago, I worked in international relief and development programs for about 20 years. I know you can't tell, right? I look so young. But I've seen hunger close up in a number of different countries and different settings. So in refugee camps where people have lost literally everything. And in rural communities where something has happened and the crop has failed and people are going hungry. And in shanty towns where there is just incredible poverty. And in war zones where transport corridors have been cut off and there's just no food coming in. And I've heard a lot of stories of hunger, and it's felt often very overwhelming. But there's one story that I think is woefully undertold, and that's that actually the world is becoming a better place. There is reason for hope. As I mentioned, there are lots of different ways of measuring hunger, and so it's not always easy to compare data sets. But I want to give you a few snapshots of trends in world hunger. So the first one, it's kind of small, it's hard to read, but the different colors represent different ways of measuring hunger. This is called the Global Hunger Index, and it measures hunger for 119 countries around the world. So it doesn't measure the very wealthiest, most developed countries, and it doesn't measure for 13 countries for which there is insufficient data available, and that includes some of the worst, like Syria and Sudan. But 119 countries is still pretty comprehensive. And the results here are shown in eight-year intervals from 1992 down to the present day. And you can see that in every region and using every different measure of hunger, hunger has fallen over that time period. In the next slide, we can see the number of people who are hungry. That's the orange line at the top. That has fallen over the last 25 years from over a billion to a little under 800 million today. Obviously, 800 million is still an incredible number of people. We have a long way to go. But it has decreased, and remember, in that time period, the population has grown substantially, enormously. So underneath that gray line, that shows the percentage of the world's population that are going hungry. And that, you can see, has almost halved from around about 24% down to about 12%, so nearly halved, which is great news. It's hopeful news. In fact, it's so hopeful that in 2015, the United Nations General Assembly said, look, we can do this. We can eradicate hunger. We already produce enough food to feed everyone on the planet right now. So if, as a global community, we prioritize this and we put resources behind it, we can eradicate hunger. And so the goal was set to get to zero hunger by the year 2030. That was the second of 17 global development goals. And you can see that the first one is no poverty, zero poverty. Again, that sounds very kind of, you know, there'll always be poverty, right? Sounds kind of overly optimistic. But again, if you look at the data, it is not that impossible. So on the next graph, we can see this is the poverty rate in Africa using World Bank statistics. Now, the axes cross at 35%, so it's not, you know, we're not, it looks like we're almost at zero. Obviously, we're not. 35% still, 35% of the population of Africa in poverty is terrible. But you look at the trend, and the trend is really encouraging. It's a great reduction. So what has led to these falling numbers of poor and hungry people in the world? Well, one factor is international aid, which if you're a taxpayer, you contribute towards. I know we have a number of people here who work in international relief and development, so you can't answer this, but does anyone want to guess, if you don't work in that sector, what percentage of our taxes, we looked last week at percentage of taxes going to military, and that was a high number. Does anyone want to guess what percentage of your taxes that you pay go to international development, relief and development? 5%? Actually, it's less than 1%. So 1.3% goes to everything international. That's diplomacy, humanitarian, development, et cetera. But less than 1% goes to development and relief efforts. So it's not a lot of money. International aid can do some amazing things. It brings water and food and electricity and basic health and education services to some people that would never receive it. I'm a big believer in international development and international aid. As I said, I worked in it for 20 years, and we have a lot of people in our community who are still active in that sector, and they can tell you, and I can tell you, lots of stories of why this is a really essential thing that we do with our income. We're not very much of our income, but it really has a key role. It's worth supporting. But aid, though, is a relatively small factor in helping countries to escape poverty. It's an essential part, but it's not the biggest factor. The fall in the prevalence of hunger and poverty is due to a complex mix of different factors, such as the process of industrialization and economic development in a number of countries, particularly in Asia. That's led to a huge decrease in hunger and poverty. Science and technology innovations in food production and food storage have been huge. The cessation of war and hostilities in some areas has led to people being able to recreate a life for themselves and be able to create income and so on. So lots of different reasons. So we have another slide here. This is called the Commitment to Development Index. This is measured by a group called the Center for Global Development, which is an independent research group based here in DC. And they measure how a country supports social and economic development overall through a number of different factors. So they look at things like trade policies, how equitable they are, making technologies available to developing countries, restricting arms flows, commitment to international agreements, immigration policies, and so on. So they look at a whole bunch of different things, and they measure this each year for 27 of the world's richest and most developed countries. You won't see the US on here because it's a ways down the list. It's currently ranked at number 23 out of 27, just behind Poland. And for the record, it has always been low. The US has always been low on this scale, but it did drop a couple of positions in the last year. So does that matter? Does it matter that as a country we're actually doing relatively little overall to impact global poverty and hunger? Or that we as individuals are probably doing pretty little. According to the Almanac of American Philanthropy, the average American gives away 4% of their income to charities, and a third of all Americans don't give anything at all. Does that matter? Well, obviously, I think it does. I think scripture is full of commands to feed the hungry and to provide for the poor and the vulnerable. I just want to give a few quick examples. So from the Jewish law, there are lots of commands about caring for the widow, the orphan, the foreigner, the poor. Here, for just one example. Since there will never cease to be some in need on the earth, I therefore command you, open your hand to the poor and needy neighbor in your land. In the wisdom literature, there's lots of sayings about how if you care for the poor, life will go well for you, and if you don't, it will go badly. Just one example. Those who give to the poor will lack nothing, but those who close their eyes to them will receive many curses. The prophets, of course, were constantly telling the people that they needed to care for the poor, for the hungry, for the vulnerable, and warning them of dire punishments if they didn't change their ways and start acting with justice and mercy. And they contrasted true worship of God, caring for the poor, being just, being merciful, with vain, empty religion. So just one brief example here. This is describing a former king. He defended the cause of the poor and the needy, and so all went well with him. Is that not what it means to know me, declares the Lord? That's what true worship is. And then in the Gospels, Jesus repeatedly aligns himself with the poor, the outcast, the marginalized, the vulnerable in society, and told a number of stories about the importance of caring for the poor, how that was what the kingdom of God was all about. So just a brief one from Matthew 25. Then the king will say to those on his right, "Come, you who are blessed by my Father, take your inheritance, the kingdom prepared for you since the creation of the world. For I was hungry, and you gave me something to eat. I was thirsty, and you gave me something to drink. I was a stranger, and you invited me in. I needed clothes, and you clothed me. I was sick, and you looked after me. I was in prison, and you came to visit me." I should mention, there are questions for each week in this series. There are questions outside, and we do look at quite a bit more at that passage in the questions, which you can go through on your own or in groups. But again, Jesus saying this is what it's all about. It's about caring for the poor. And then the letters to the early church communities, again, had this theme repeated throughout. So again, just one quick verse. If anyone has material possessions and sees a brother or sister in need but has no pity on them, how can the love of God be in that person? So all throughout Scripture, in all different types of writings, we get this common theme of the need to care for the poor, to ensure that the hungry are fed, that the vulnerable are taken care of, to give generously, recognizing that everything we have comes from God, and that we're called to care for one another. And this persistent theme in Scripture is particularly directed at religious people, at people who claim to be on God's side. So I want to read this passage. This is a longer passage from Isaiah. I'm going to read it in the Message, which is a modern translation. "Shout, a full-throated shout. Hold nothing back, a trumpet blast shout. Tell my people what's wrong with their lives. Face my family Jacob with their sins. They're busy, busy, busy at worship and love studying all about me. To all appearances, they're a nation of right-living people, law-abiding, God-honoring. They ask me, what's the right thing to do? I love having me on their side. But they also complain, why do we fast and you don't look our way? Why do we humble ourselves and you don't even notice? Well, here's why. The bottom line of your fast days is profit. You drive your employees much too hard. You fast, but at the same time you bicker and fight. You fast, but you swing a mean fist. The kind of fasting you do won't get your prayers off the ground. Do you think this is the kind of fast day I'm after? A day to show off humility? To put on a pious, long face and parade around solemnly in black? Do you call that fasting a fast day that I, God, would like? This is the kind of fast day I'm after. To break the chains of injustice. Get rid of exploitation in the workplace. Free the oppressed. Cancel debts. What I'm interested in seeing you do is sharing your food with the hungry. Inviting the homeless poor into your homes. Putting clothes on the shivering, ill-clad, being available to your own families. Do this, and the lights will turn on, and your lives will turn around at once. Your righteousness will pave your way. The God of glory will secure your passage. Then when you pray, God will answer. You'll call out for help, and I'll say, here I am. If you get rid of unfair practices, quit blaming victims, quit gossiping about other people's sins. If you are generous with the hungry and start giving yourselves to the down and out, your lives will begin to glow in the darkness. Your shadowed lives will be bathed in sunlight. I will always show you where to go. I will give you a full life in the emptiest of places. Firm muscles, strong bones. You'll be like a well-watered garden, a gurgling spring that never runs dry. You'll use the old rubble of past lives to build anew, rebuild the foundations from out of your past. You will be known as those who can fix anything, restore old ruins, rebuild and renovate, make the community livable again." I love that imagery at the end. We get to be those who can fix anything, who restore, who rebuild. Hunger and poverty are not apocalyptic issues where it's just going to get worse and worse and worse and there's really nothing you can do. It's not. We get to be part of making life livable. We get to join in the godly work of rebuilding and restoring. This is hopeful work. This is productive, meaningful work. The prophet Micah summed it up this way. He has shown you, O mortal, what is good. And what does the Lord require of you? To act justly and to love mercy and to walk humbly with your God. Justice and mercy. I've shown this picture before, but I really like it. This is the sculpture of an angel of mercy holding back Lady Justice. Justice, of course, is giving people what is their right. It's giving them what they deserve, what they're entitled to. Mercy is going way beyond that. It's offering kindness beyond what's fair, beyond what's necessary, being generous and compassionate. And this is what we're called to throughout Scripture, justice and mercy. We just read about both of those in that passage from Isaiah, where the religious people are told to break the chains of injustice, get rid of exploitation in the workplace, free the oppressed, get rid of unfair practice. That's a justice element. But then Isaiah also says, cancel debts. It's not fair, but do it. Cancel debts. Share your food with the hungry. Invite the homeless poor into your homes. Put clothes on the ill-clad. Be generous with the hungry and start giving yourselves to the down and outs. Well, one way we as a community try to demonstrate justice and mercy to people who are materially poorer than we are is through our partnership with IPALA Guatemala. IPALA is a very resource-poor part of Guatemala. There are not a lot of economic opportunities there. The local economy is almost all agricultural. And so when the rains don't come, or when they come late, or when there are floods, like there were this year, there can be a lot of hunger and food insecurity. Illiteracy rates are very high in Guatemala. People can't afford the costs associated with school. They can't afford the books and the uniforms and so on. And they end up trapped in a cycle of poverty. And Guatemala largely got this way because of a 36-year civil war in which the American government and American businesses played a very key role. So this is a justice issue as well as an issue of mercy. The country continues to struggle with a lot of political corruption and high rates of unemployment and so on. So we've been working with the people in IPALA and the people who originally from IPALA that now live in Maryland for about 8 or 9 years. And the leaders in the IPALA community have identified health and education as two priorities. So in response, we have provided support to the purchase of smokeless stoves. Many of you, I know, have contributed towards those. That helps with respiratory health issues. Contributed as a church community, we've contributed to the construction of homes and improvements to homes, to medicines and nutritional supplements, and to scholarships for low-income middle and high school students, and to school construction projects. And every year, as I'm sure many of you know, a group of us goes down to Guatemala to spend time with the people there. And the Stryker family went there this summer. So I'd like to invite them up to come and tell us a little bit about their time there. So let me grab a microphone for you. So Rebecca, let's start with you. Could you tell us a little bit, do you need this?
Sure.
Could you tell us a little bit about some of the things that you saw while you were down there?
Yeah. Well, first of all, good morning. I'm Rebecca Stryker. This is my son, Tim, and my husband, Ethan, and our daughter, Maddie, went with us as well. We were really just so privileged to go to IPALA with the Cedar Ridge team this past summer. And we had a great time. We were there really getting to know the IPALAN people. They were just so wonderful, so welcoming, so loving, and it was wonderful, and it was great to get to know the people in our own church who went too, and we just had fun, you know. We had a great time going, and we did lots of things. Tim's going to tell you a few of the things that we did, but although it was so much fun, it was really eye-opening as well. For me, it was very educational, almost more than anything else, because it really opened my eyes to what their living situation is like there now, and opened my eyes to see, wow, this is what Cedar Ridge is doing to help and to partner with the people there. And it was really incredible. But some of the things that we saw, there were definitely so many families that live in poverty. There was a lot of poverty. And you kind of go with that expectation, but it really hits you when you're walking among the villages and seeing what you see. A lot of the homes were constructed with adobe bricks. I had never seen adobe before. You can see the house on the left there is adobe. A lot of the houses are just kind of put together with sticks, corrugated metal, tarps. Many homes had dirt floors, not much concrete there. When we went, there had been recent flooding, which had caused damage to some homes. One home in particular had collapsed, and the team worked to kind of take that down to prepare it for rebuilding. Ethan, I'll talk more about that in a minute. The houses were small. They, as you can see, they were open to the elements. There were chickens and stray dogs that just kind of roamed around freely. And there was corn. There was maize everywhere. If there was an empty square foot, there was maize growing there. In terms of electricity, there was very little electricity, running water. In Ipala proper, there was, you know, they did have electricity and running water, but in the villages surrounding, it was sparse. You can see here that they collected water in tanks. They just didn't have access to public water. This next photo that we have, this is a bathroom in a home. That's how they would shower. Just a tarp. What?
Yeah.
It's a shower, sorry. Not like a toilet, like a shower. And this is where they would clean themselves, and it's just completely open. But beyond that, I was particularly humbled by the problems I saw due to lack of proper nutrition and health care. Many people, children and adults alike, had missing teeth, or they had permanent crowns. And that kind of struck me. Ended up finding out that there is no preventative dental care in Ipala, like none. That's not a thing. They only react to if you have a toothache or if something goes wrong, and then they pull it, and sometimes you can get a crown. So that was really troubling to me. I also found out that there's a lot of sugar in the Ipalan diet, which I didn't know. They drink a lot of soda, which I wouldn't have expected. And also they eat a lot of maize. Their main food source is maize, which basically is sugar. So that has lots of effects dietarily. And even though they don't look like it, a lot of the people are malnourished because they're eating so much maize. They really don't have a well-rounded diet. It was rare to go to a village home and see anything else being grown besides corn. And at one point we met with a local doctor who had done some research on malnutrition in babies, and her results indicated that many of the children did have low iron and hemoglobin levels, and that could be really dangerous for their development as well.
Thank you. So Tim, can you tell us a little bit about what you did while you were there to address maybe some of the issues that Becca was talking about, your mom was talking about?
So some of the things we did in Guatemala, we delivered the smokeless stoves to the houses that were, like, they needed it. Like, they had no, like, air ventilation or anything. We also passed out some medication and vitamins to the elderly at a home. See over there. So those vitamins were supposed to last them for the year, just to help their health. We also served in the soup kitchen. And so some people helped make a dinner, and some people helped pass out, as you can see over there. We also handed out some toothbrushes and t-shirts at a pool party that we hosted. To the little boys and girls. We visited some schools and a computer lab that we helped support, and just visited them and had fun with them. And we also helped tear down an adobe house that my mom was talking about, and we just cleared it off and tried to get it ready for the rebuild. And yeah, you can see over there. That's people just moving the adobe brick and other things.
Okay. So Ethan, how much of this is creating dependency and how much are we empowering people to actually act in their own interests?
Yeah, so one thing that I, well, a bunch of things that I learned down there were how these efforts, how we help give, really do help in the long term. So you mentioned earlier the scholarship. So there's 60 students, middle school and high school, that we sponsor, and that helps in the long term because these kids are getting an education that's helping to bring resources back to their family. And one of the fathers of a scholarship student over there on the right there, so on the somewhere in the middle, I can't point, but is one of our scholarship students. And the gentleman on the right there, Francisco, he said something that I think all the entire team really were affected by. And he said, life is hard here, but the help that Cedar Ridge gives makes it less difficult. And you know, it is a long-term benefit, I think. And by the way, he was one of the guys that went across town to help with that Adobe house build. Like, he's in need himself, but he was going across town to help other people, which also helps in the long term. If one of the things we talked about was just kind of creating a spirit of helping each other, a spirit of community. And so people that were getting help were helping others, and that has a long-term effect. And another thing, too, is something that struck me was that the people down there, it wasn't like they were just helpless victims. They're very smart. They had ingenuity. And if they received resources, they used it in a smart way. And I think the next picture, yeah, this the lady there on the left, Heidi, purchased a diesel corn grinder that instead of having to bring your corn into town to have it ground so you could make tortillas, she had her own grinder out in the villages that people would bring it to. So it was less distance for people. And for her, it was a way to support her family. And by the way, she was also supporting two kids, you know, of extended family whose parents, you know, tragically passed away. And so, again, it's ingenuity. Yeah, there's a picture of the grinder there. And it's taking resources for and using it for the long term. What was I going to say? Oh, right. And in fact, in that first house that we saw, they brought a little hand grinder, you know, and they had, you know, this little Adobe house, stick built, and they said, you know, if we buy this, it's a little bit extra money up front, but it's less in the long run. So, again, they're just really smart people. And I think the nutrition, the area of nutrition is kind of like what we're exploring next as a group here and down there. And, you know, helping the nutrition, especially of young babies and their development, I think will have a huge long lasting effects.
Great. Thank you so much. Let's give them a round of applause. Each of us can make a difference. This is something that we can all do something about. It might only be a small thing that we can do, but those small things add up. The Irish statesman Sir Edmund Burke said this: "No one made a greater mistake than he who did nothing because he could only do a little." And those little things not only have a cumulative effect, you know that word I'm trying to say, adding up effect around the world, but they also have a huge impact on us. And I'm sure you would say that, right, guys, that as much impact as you had in Guatemala, you probably had more impact on yourself, right? It really impacts how we view our own lives, our own situation, can make us feel so much how we're incredibly blessed, how we want to be helpful to others, how we want to share, how we want to be generous, how we want to make a difference. So what are some of the things that we can all do? Well, first, we can pray. We can all pray for the poor. We know that God cares about the poor. This is not a case of us trying to get God to care about the poor. This is much more about us aligning ourselves with God and saying we care too, that we share God's longing for justice and for mercy. But let's also pray that God will show us ways that we can act. And some of the things that we can do is be ethical consumers. We can buy fair trade. We can buy ethically sourced goods. Matthew mentioned that week on Saturday is the Christmas party here when there will be vendors of ethically sourced and fair trade products. It's a great place to put that into action. We can decide not to shop at certain stores that we know have a reputation for driving down prices to the point that their employees can't make a decent living and their suppliers can't either. There are certain products that you might want to boycott. There are a number of websites that can tell you about certain products that are produced in very unethical ways. There's a great website that's called slaveryfootprint.org that will particularly show you about some of the unfair forced labor issues behind certain products. We can give financially. We can give to organizations that promote the dignity of the poor, that do empower them, that don't create dependency, but do empower the poor. We can give to our work here in Apala. We can advocate for the poor. We can call political leaders and managers of stores that we buy from to account. We can support programs like food stamps, after-school programs, Meals on Wheels, those kind of things that are often under the budget cuts. We can add our voice on the side of the poor. And there are practical ways to get involved. You can get involved, obviously, outside of Cedar Ridge, but here at Cedar Ridge, too, we can volunteer on the farm next year, put together food donations for the backpack program for Greencastle Elementary School, the Thanksgiving baskets that were mentioned, get involved in our work in Apala. So there are lots of ways, and there are on the communion tables, there is a flyer with more details about some of those ways that we can all get involved. So we are going to take communion now. And communion is a symbolic meal that is rich with meaning. This ritual uses what were, at the time of Jesus, very everyday elements of food and drink, bread and wine. There were inclusive symbols, universal symbols. We all need food, we all need drink, just as we all need forgiveness and healing and community and oneness and all those other elements of following Jesus that we celebrate through the ritual of communion. I think it's very significant that when Jesus gave us his ritual, he didn't use incense or bells or some, you know, he didn't use religious symbols. He chose bread and wine, everyday food and drink. I think it's important to think about that because for many of us, myself included, we tend to think of worship as something mysterious and esoteric and transcendent, and it can have those elements. But through the prophets, God made that point over and over again that true worship is going out and feeding the hungry and taking care of the poor. When Jesus taught his disciples to pray, he juxtaposed, "May your kingdom come, may your will be done," with, "Give us this day our daily bread." So to follow Jesus is both celebrating this symbolic ritual of bread and wine, but also literally going out to feed the hungry and to care for the poor. So I want us to keep both of those aspects in mind as we take communion today. And that's why I've put the handouts deliberately on the communion tables rather than at another side table, because the two things go together. It is the connection between that internal worship of the communion ritual and the outward worship through our lives that we're called in how we use our money, our time, our voice. Also, during this time of communion, you can make a financial gift. You can write out prayers and put them in the frames at the side, or you can pray with someone at the back. So let's pray together now. Dear God, we thank you for feeding us. We so often take for granted things like food and shelter and clothing and all the incredible material blessings that you have given to us that we just do take for granted. We do want to thank you for those. I pray that you would give us grateful hearts, that we would recognize how incredibly blessed we are. I also pray that you would give us soft hearts, that we wouldn't harden our hearts to the poor and to the hungry, that you would help us to be compassionate, to be moved, to see and to care and to act. I thank you that you invite us to partner with you in making the world a better place. Pray that you'd grant us the wisdom to know what to do and how to worship you, not just with our lips, but with the whole of our lives, in every aspect of the way we live. Amen.
I open my heart like a window to you, a gentle yet powerful wind.